The U.S. Supreme Court this week upheld a Court of Appeals ruling which validated and upheld Wisconsin's photo ID law that passed in 2011 and had been the subject of a badminton game in the federal and state courts. So to talk about what it all means, thanks to Kevin Kennedy, Director and General Counsel of the Government Accountability Board. Kevin, I'm glad you're back.
Well, thank you. And so is photo ID.
Yeah, thank you. But then immediately, the GAB's first statement said, we're consulting with Department of Justice. And then a matter of minutes, the Attorney General, Brad Schimel, said this will not be, let's say not again, not be in effect for the April 7th spring election, right?
That's right.
Well, that's my first question. Is that final, or can groups like the ACLU, which immediately put out a press release saying, you know, we're going to try to throw a Hail Mary pass, is that final, definite, Finney?
I can't envision a scenario where photo ID would be in place for the April 7th election. I mean, when we said on Monday morning we were consulting with the AG, we had already consulted with the Attorney General's office. We had raised the concern knowing that the court was holding its conference on Friday, March 20th, as to whether or not they would take the case,
yeah.
That it was possible that by Monday morning they might make that decision. We'd be 2 weeks out from the election. We wanted to make sure that, you know, given the Supreme Court's deference to not changing the game right before an election, mm-hmm. that this was on their plate. We deferred to the Attorney General's office and how they'd handle it. We had talked. We had an understanding from our conversations. They agreed with us that it could not be enforced before the election, given the timing, the fact that absentee ballots were already out in the hands of people requesting them by mail. In some cases, they were being voted in nursing homes. And on March 23rd, the day that the Supreme Court declined to take up the case, we knew that in-person absentee voting was starting in municipal clerk's offices across the state. So we wanted to make sure that the courts understood that the Attorney General's office was representing us, and make sure we had the right advice. They assured us they would, you know, take the steps to make sure that the court was aware of this. They agreed with us in those discussions that they didn't think that we could effectively do this, but we hadn't gotten a final sign-off on this. So our initial comment, of course, was we will consult with the Attorney General's office while they were on the phone right after the press was on the phone with us. So
okay.
We did get their backing that's right, that we could not effectively enforce this, and so we should move forward without it.
So when the Attorney General said this decision is final, it is final?
It's final. You know, in our earlier discussions, we talked about the fact there were very procedural steps. When the Supreme Court declines to take a case, it goes back to the Seventh Circuit.
Yes.
It has to issue a mandate, which goes back to the district court, and the timing can be in flux
yeah.
as a result of that. You never can predict what it's going to be. The Seventh Circuit on Wednesday afternoon said we're not even going to issue a stay in light of this because Wisconsin doesn't believe they can enforce it, so there's no controversy here.
Okay. Voters who are registered, and you said there's, what, about 3.5 million of them?
We have about 3.5 million registered voters.
Will not have to show a photo ID on April 7th?
That's right.
What about if I'm registering for the first time on April 7th? Then I have to show the normal document.
That's right, but
correct?
That's
a separate process.
That's a separate process. When you register to vote in Wisconsin, you have to provide what we call current proof of residence, which is an identifying document, which is often a photo ID. The most common form is the driver's license or the state-issued ID card.
Mm-hmm.
That's what most people show. But if their address isn't current, it doesn't do them any good in those last 8 years, so it's not unusual that what someone's carrying in their pocket doesn't help them for registering to vote, but it might help them as far as meeting the voter ID requirement in the future.
But if someone registers to vote for the first time in Wisconsin on April 7th, they're not caught up in the photo ID law, correct?
That's right.
What about if someone just moved and is going to a new polling place?
Again, it's a registration requirement. They have to show current proof of residence. That can be a utility bill, a cell phone bill. There's a whole list of documents that you can use. The important thing there is it's in the category defined by statute. It's current, has the person's full name on it.
Okay.
Because you have to establish proof of residence. It's not a picture ID all the time on that. In the future, and we have two special elections scheduled for May 19th.
May 19th?
School districts.
Okay.
Voters will have to show voter ID. Now, because those are in small school districts, we'll be working directly with the municipal clerks on training and outreach. You know, there won't be a big media campaign for special elections. We anticipate there'll be some special elections between now and the end of 2015. And they really give us a good opportunity to sort of roll out, you know, how we implement things, get some feedback on what people's reaction is. I mean, the truth is, photo ID has been in front of the public since 2011.
Yes.
Most people assume they should have it. It was not unusual in 2012 and 2014 for people to be pulling out their driver's license and be told, we don't need to see that. So it's really a question of making sure, one, that in these special elections people are aware of it, and two, we begin to work with community groups to reach those segments of the populace that we know have a difficult time with this, because we do have that outreach directive. So we'll be reaching out to people who serve students, the elderly, minority communities, people closer to the poverty level, because we know those are the people who may not have acceptable forms of ID. And really all we can do is get to the service providers, the people who provide them a level of support, make sure they have the tools to assist them. You know, we can't reach those individuals. You know, the court cases said, you know, you had anywhere from 50,000 to 300,000 people who would fall in the category of voting age population, but may not have that identification.
Potentially disenfranchised by that.
That's right.
Not
able to participate if they can't get there.
Right. Before we're done with the April 7th, let me ask you, in 2013, I looked it up, 18% of the voters voted. That was Supreme Court Justice Rogenczak was reelected. What's your projection?
It was actually about 21%.
21%? Thanks for the correction.
Yeah.
What are you projecting for April 7th?
We're looking at about a 20% turnout.
Okay.
You know, Rogenczak, Fallon had a lot of a discussion. You know, candidate Fallon was pretty active in getting his issues in front, and that's really what drives this, is how much awareness does the public have of the race, how much of a stake do they have in it. You know, this election, you know, it's a pretty similar campaign, an incumbent justice with a fairly articulate challenger, you know, making his presence felt in a very grassroots fashion. But we also have a constitutional amendment affecting the courts,
right,
that focus some more attention. But historically, in a non-presidential preference year, or absent the sea-changing events we saw in 2011, where the court race was really a referendum on what was happening in the legislature, 20% is about what you expect in that kind of spring election.
Now let's talk about April 8th and going forward. Photo ID is the law of the land in Wisconsin. So for special elections, and you said there are two, are they school district referendums on May 19th?
Two school districts.
Which communities do you
know? I don't recall what they are. You know,
but for any special election or school district, any election, local or state, after April 8th, you must show a photo ID.
In order to get a ballot, and as well as to request an absentee ballot, you have to have. There are a number of exceptions to this, and that's why I said it'll be important to work. These will be very low turnout elections, but we want to make sure the municipal clerks, all the materials that we designed for them in 2011 and all the training we did in 2011 and early 2012, you know, we had dusted it off in the fall of 2014, and we're dusting it off again. And I think this really gives us a good targeted area to hone those skills as we go into 2012.
What about an absent
2016?
How do you verify? How does the photo ID law come into play if you're seeking a absentee ballot?
Well, first, if you vote in person, it's very simple. You have to show the ID to get the absentee ballot. If you vote by mail, there's a number of exceptions to that. And once you've shown ID, if you're on the permanent list, you don't have to show it again. In nursing homes, the special voting deputies who take the ballots can vouch for you. You don't have to show the ID. Okay. There's exceptions for people with disabilities. We also have, again, you know, you send in a copy of that ID, and the clerk is required to keep a record that they have received the ID, and it's not necessary for subsequent elections. It's a much smaller population of people who vote absentee by mail.
By mail.
You know, if you take the presidential election years where we have close to 24% of the people voting absentee
in the presidential election most year, of them which are is next year.
Yeah, most of them are in person. So it's a much smaller group of people voting absentee who are getting it by mail. And a good chunk of those people are military and overseas voters who are exempt from that requirement.
Okay. So the only thing, now let's look ahead at the election calendar. We have May 19th school district referendums in two communities. You're not aware of any other special elections for state office?
There's the possibility.
I understand.
Of things coming up.
In which case, photo ID would be required.
That's right.
Then let's look ahead to next year. The first major election that all voters should know they're going to have to show a photo ID, is that the April 5 primary? Is that our presidential primary?
That's our presidential primary, but we have a nonpartisan primary the third week in February.
Okay, thank you.
And with what looks like an open seat on the Supreme Court, we could have a statewide primary.
That's right. That's
in
Justice
February.
Crooks has announced he'll
not
be seeking re-election. Okay. So if we have a primary for the Supreme Court, it would be the third week in February. But there is a regular spring primary third week in February.
That's right.
And then leap forward to the April 5 presidential primary.
That would be a good-sized election. It's our presidential preference. It's an open presidential seat, so you're going to see contested primaries.
And we could have the name of Scott K. Walker on the ballot.
That's right.
Which would drive up turnout.
I think that would drive up turnout. You know, that's an election where you expect at least 40% of the voters to come out to vote. When, you know, where Wisconsin is, they're not at the end, they're not at the beginning of the season, so I would think that ideally, you know, decisions will still need to be made as to who the nominee is on both sides, and that will be a factor in driving up turnout. There is legislation introduced to move it up to the third Tuesday in February, but I think that's not going to go very far. Part of that is that it really pushes the envelope for what the political parties want.
Yeah.
You know, they want the early primaries in the traditional states.
Okay.
And so I think there will be some.
So we're looking at four statewide elections next year. The February, third week in February primary, the April 5 presidential primary, the normal August partisan primary.
Right. Second week in August.
Thank you. And then the November general election.
That's right.
And the takeaway here is that bring a photo ID to vote in all those four elections and any special elections, right?
That's exactly it.
Okay.
Be prepared.
But as you said, local clerks have been trained. This is not a new issue. You've been working with them, and they've built their scenarios since 2011. So all we got this week is Finney. It's in place, right?
Right. And it's probably the best timing for the decision. On this, because it gives us a lot of lead time. It gives us the special elections to prepare, without a media campaign in place. It just becomes part of the, you know, be prepared for the election. You're going to need to show this, working with community groups, because presidential elections always drive things, whether it's the primary or the general election. This is what gets people going, and, you know, we won't have an incumbent president running for re-election, so it'll be a huge election.
Yeah, big turnout election. Okay, let's turn the corner. I was intrigued by your testimony before a legislative committee this week, and you said what I've been kind of wondering, in the wake of federal and state court rulings, your term, our current campaign finance laws are wholly inadequate. Is that because they were written in 1974?
That's because they were written in 1974, and we have a series of court cases. But, you know, and that's actually a historical term, as we talked about. That's a term I stole from
the report.
Professor Adamatti when he wrote the report in March of 1974. Looking at Wisconsin's history, we have been on the cutting edge of campaign finance disclosure. 1911, we had our Corrupt Practices Act, which really brought sunshine into the funding of campaigns. Very small amounts of money had to be disclosed with the Secretary of State.
Right.
And by 1974, what we saw wasn't that the courts had undermined that, but that the bureaucrats had undermined that. That the Secretary of State was, you know, collecting paper records, but no one was make hide or hair of them. The laws were written so that people could have multiple committees, could get around any contribution limits, and there was absolutely no enforcement. It was all in the hands of district attorneys. You know, 1974, a great restatement of the law, which said, you know, what's at the heart of our representative government is the need for an informed electorate, and the best way they get that is learning what are the sources of support for candidates, against candidates.
Disclosure.
We have gone, you know, in the 40-plus years since 1974, from paper filings in our office with some duplicates in other offices to online access to information. And that part of our law is very good. You know, it's within, on the filing deadline, you know, we see news articles out there. Here's where candidate X got its support. Here's how much money this political party spent on behalf of candidates.
Right.
And that's, you know, we want to make sure we keep that information. You know, what was challenged was the series of contribution limits. In the 70s, there were challenges to expenditure limits. I mean, the role of the First Amendment is where we have fallen behind on this, because a lot of the contribution limits we put in place had the effect of tamping down people's right to speak in these campaigns. And that's really where we're, you know, and the GAB and its predecessor, the Elections Board, said, you know, change is coming. You need to make adjustments. And after the 2010 Citizens United decision,
right,
legislation was talked about, some was introduced, but no action was taken. So the fact that we've had this parade of court cases coming out in 2014,
yeah,
following the 2010 decision, a lot of that could have been averted had we been more proactive, and by we, I mean the legislature, in responding to Citizens United.
Okay, and I really want to go deeper here, because you have said the heart of Wisconsin's campaign finance law is the requirement that you disclose who gave to a candidate, how much, and when. Does that remain in place given the, to use your term, the parade of court rulings that you've seen over the last 18 months?
It does. Some people, some entities that are making political speech, which may not fall into the First Amendment's requirements for regulation, meaning it's not express advocacy of a clearly identified candidate or its functional equivalent of express advocacy,
yes,
but is really more issue-related discussion, even though its timing and its influence is clearly political in nature, will be excluded from that. But the vast bulk of money that's being spent is still subject to disclosure, and it still is a source. I mean, my mother always told me when I was growing up, you're going to be judged by the company you keep, and that's what candidates running for political office understand.
But we are in an era where a $700,000 donation from Gogebic Taconite to Republicans in 2012, that doesn't come out on a GAB form. And the news report this week, then I have no idea whether it's true or not, but Yahoo News reported John Menard gave $1.5 million to Club for Growth. That's not disclosed on GAB forms. So is it still, is our centerpiece disclosure still an effective way of making voters aware of who gave and how much and when?
Well, in those contributions, I can't speak too much about them because I don't have a lot of the information on them, but, you know, where they went or the accuracy of those. But, I mean, we get the information when you're talking about entities that are organized for a political purpose, candidate committees, political party committees, political action committees, where their, you know, major purpose is to elect or defeat candidates, pass or defeat a referendum. We see that level of expenditure. We see most ads that may not be subject to regulation that come out, you have a sense of what's behind them. You may not have all of the detail that you have with campaign finance.
Right.
There's a lot of money that is spent, and you do get a lot of information out there. There's also a lot of information that comes out that doesn't cost any money. The internet and YouTube videos make a lot of information about candidates and about the issues in front of the public very accessible. So we have a lot more information. We don't always know everything behind it, but it sparks the debate. And we talked about this in the hearing. You know, discussions around political issues are not debating societies. You know, it's a rough and tumble exchange of ideas. I think the Founding Fathers' sense and the experience is, and you go back and you look at the debates in the 1800s during the Progressive Movement, there was a lot of vitriol and some of that. It's not a polite, I disagree with you, ma'am. I disagree with you, sir. It's a, you just don't know what the hell you're talking about. There's a lot of, and some people would prefer it to be neater, but it's a give and take. And, you know, when you take a position supporting someone by making a campaign contribution, signing a nomination paper or a recall petition or putting a yard sign up, you join that debate. And that's what we expect in the society, is that there's going to be a give and take.
Right.
On this, and people have different comfort levels on that, and people have different knowledge levels, but that's, you know, we have so much information, and we do a good job right now of where candidates are getting that money directly, where the political parties are, of getting a sense of that, and you can usually extrapolate from that.
But I cannot look up who gave to Club for Growth or to Our American Revival, certainly not on GAB. Is that because those are federally created
entities? They're regulated under a different structure.
Okay.
I mean, there is some disclosure for some of that activity, you know, to the extent that they are a 501c4. They file annual disclosures.
With the FEC, Federal Election Commission?
No, with the IRS.
Thank you. Thank you.
And so there is some disclosure of that activity. Again, you're getting information out. And sometimes, you know, we have some history of anonymous speech as well. You know, when we look at crafting laws, we want to make sure that our candidates aren't getting so much money that it's essentially a quid pro quo or an apparent quid pro quo for that. But we also want to be able to evaluate, well, they say they're for this, but look where they're getting their money. It seems to be a different source.
Contradiction.
You know, it's a way of adding information, because you know, what's said in debate is always questioned. It's supposed to be tested by a give and take, but it's hard to have a give and take with a television commercial.
But I was intrigued. On January 13th, the GAB board, the full board that you report to, passed a resolution, and the list of things it says we need help clarifying is just pretty stunning. Definition of a political purpose, registration and reporting requirements, what coordination between a candidate and other committees should be permissible, whether and what type of corporate contribution should be allowed, adjusting or eliminating contribution limits enacted in the 1970s. This is a long list that the GAB is saying, is the GAB, when it says, is it saying we don't know what rules apply?
No, what we're saying is the court cases have raised the fact that Wisconsin's current definition of political purpose, what activity is subject to regulation, is outmoded. It needs to conform to current First Amendment principles. That's the first point. The contribution limit issue.
Are there any anymore?
There are certainly contribution limits. The courts have said, you know, contribution limits are important. You can regulate them. We have several states that don't have them. They think disclosure covers everything, but the courts have said contribution limits are constitutionally defensible as opposed to spending limits. They're not contribution limits in the sense that, you know, one of the things that was struck down was the idea that an individual can't give more than $10,000 total in a year.
Yeah.
That's not really a contribution limit. That's a limit on how much they can spend. And that's why that was struck down.
Two specific questions. Can somebody now, the 1974 law said no one person can give more than $10,000 to a candidate for governor, attorney general, or Supreme Court candidate. Is that $10,000 limit still in effect in Wisconsin?
That's still in effect in Wisconsin, and it's still constitutional. Maybe it needs to be fine-tuned. Most people would say $10,000 hasn't changed much in 40 years in terms of a contribution to a statewide candidate, but a lot of people would argue that $500 may have been high in 1974, but maybe it's low in 2015 for an assembly candidate, and that's where you get the debate.
Yep.
Is what's that level?
Yep.
That you want, and it's, you know, some people confuse this with, we set it at 500 because we think that at $500.01 a candidate's going to sell their vote. No, we just don't want them to be overly dependent on large contributions, because there is a recognition with human nature that the more money you get, the more reliant you become on a single source, the more inclined you are to give that benefit. That's
even the U.S. Supreme Court agreed in the Caperton case. What about, we've had a ban on corporate donations for more than 100 years. In light of these questions raised by the GAB board, is the ban on corporate donations still in effect?
It's still in effect, and you know, it's in effect at the federal level. It's in effect in several states. It's not a constitutional issue. It's a policy issue. A lot of states allow corporations to do that. You take a look at how we structure a lot of our small businesses, you know, which are essentially a reflection of an individual or two or a family. But they're incorporated. They're structured in a way that they could not give directly out of that. It would have to come out of their pockets. And that's for the legislature to evaluate, do we want to continue that ban on that? Corporations clearly cannot give directly to candidates or political parties or political action committees, but they can speak on their own. They can take out their own ads.
They can give to these 501(c)(3), which one?
C's? 501(c)(3), C4s.
Okay.
You know, they can make those contributions. Which, you know, those are charitable organizations that have limited ability. You know, their major purpose can't be, their primary purpose can't be politics, but obviously issue groups organized, you know, have a political bent to them. In many cases, they're trying to influence policy.
In the Capitol, there's always a party in power and a party out of power. Is there enough concern on the part of the current party in power about these questions raised by GAB? Do you think legislators will address this? Because there's also a separate bill which you and I haven't seen that would change the organizational structure of the GAB. So my question is there an awareness and a commitment to act on some of these questions raised on the campaign finance side?
I think there is. The fact that we had a three-hour hearing that the legislature started out with, let's hear from the person who administers the law, the agency that administers it. Let's hear from one of our prominent local practitioners. Let's hear from the good government people and their views on this. Let's hear from the people who are bringing these lawsuits that were attacking our law. They got six people who, you know, were making a presentation in question for half an hour each to get a whole series of views on this. And that's a good starting point.
Okay.
In the past, we've had some comprehensive studies on this, and that was what the board urged, is that, you know, you need to do that. The legislature is responding in the sense that we're going to start our process here. They'll go do some drafting. They'll put something out. You know, ideally, they can come to some resolution by the end of this year so that when we get into 2016 and we're starting those fall campaigns,
well, that was my next question.
The rules have changed.
The resolution passed by the GAB board, and the judges sit on it, asks for a legislative council study committee to study just these very complex issues. If there's a legislative council study committee, and if it makes recommendations, and if those recommendations, you notice there's three ifs there, are enacted into law, would any changes be in place for 2016, or would they have to catch the next election cycle?
If they move fast enough, yes. So okay. There's a fourth if.
Okay.
But you know, the point is, in 2010, campaign finance should have had more of the attention of the legislature.
Yep.
It certainly seems to have the attention now.
Okay.
Of the legislature.
Okay.
And they've started to act on that. Even last fall, a lot of the discussion of the legislative leaders was, this was a priority for us to do. Now, when you get into the session and you start with the budget and you get an influx of new legislators, there are other issues that pop into place, but this is clearly important to them.
But given the complexity of this issue, and I found out legislators, they all consider themselves many experts on campaign finance law, given the complexity and given the self-interest of lawmakers, let me ask this question. What happens if there's no major answers to these questions raised by the GAB?
Well, you know,
who wins?
We ran the 2014 elections. It's not a question of winning or losing. We ran the 2014 elections under the rules. Lots of disclosure still available. What you didn't have, and that's because the court stopped it, were, you know, we couldn't enforce certain provisions of the law, and we won't enforce those because the courts have said you can't.
Enjoined you.
And what I think the legislature recognizes is we can't rely on having court decisions out there. We need to have a roadmap that people can see in the statutes. We shouldn't have the GAB saying, well, the statutes say this, but the courts tell us this. They want, I mean, that's why we have statutes, is to give a clear roadmap.
Okay.
And so that's where they're heading. If nothing happens between now and 2016, you know, the main thing is you'll see elections run like they were in 2014, a lot of disclosure about the activity, and a lot of clarifying advice by attorneys and the GAB saying, remember, you know, there's no cumulative contribution limit restrictions, but we still have bans on corporate contribution. We still have requirements to disclose where your money's coming from, and we still have individual contribution limits.
Okay. Now, one question I like to pose to those I interview is, what's at stake? But it seems to me you answered that in your testimony this week when you said, the conduct and financing of political campaigns is at the heart of our representative form of government. Close with why you put that sentence in there.
Because that was a good closing. I put it in there because too often, you know, we don't pay attention to how campaigns are run. And when you're looking at Chapter 11, you want there to be serious attention paid to it. And so the idea was to remind people, this is a big thing. When we don't have a legislature or a governor or a Congress or a president if we don't have the give and take of political campaigns. And you want some clear rules about how they're conducted, and you want them done consistent with our fundamental principles, which include, you know, the First Amendment of you can say just about anything you want as long as you're not lying. You can be mean, mm-hmm. but you can be lofty in principle as well.
Okay. Well, let's go back to the way we started the show. As a result of the U.S. Supreme Court photo ID here in Wisconsin beginning September or April 8th, right?
That's right.
Okay. Kevin Kennedy, Director and General Counsel of the Government Accountability Board. Thanks for coming back to Wisconsin Eye.
Thanks for having me.
You bet.